series with the Cleveland Cavaliers, Game 1 Thursday night. Now the WGTD Tuesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Partly sunny, very warm. Today's high 85, inland cooler near Lake Michigan. 60% chance of rain tonight. Then it looks like a rainy Wednesday for sure. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms. A high of 78 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. New numbers are in. Wind is calm. Sun is shining. Now 69 degrees in Kenosha. 70 in Racine. 71 in Milwaukee. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very, very happy indeed to be able to be speaking today on the Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear, who is a faculty colleague of mine at Carthage College, director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country. And Professor Sear joins us on a monthly basis to offer his perspective on various issues and questions and concerns, both domestic and international, that seem to be perpetually confronting us these days. And these are conversations that I know many of you really look forward to, as do I. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. You're most gracious.
Good to have you here. I think before we let too much time go by, we should probably talk about the very special guest who came to the campus of Carthage College this past week, namely Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian John Meacham, for a public event Saturday afternoon and then commencement itself on Sunday, at which he gave a commencement address. And I'm very, very anxious to hear from you, your thoughts on what John Meacham had to say at both of these events. I know you were at both of them, and I know that to a large extent, the two of you share the same wisdom in realizing that in many cases, if you want to understand what we're experiencing right now, it makes all the sense in the world to do some looking back at the historical context out of which our present-day pleasures and troubles typically emerge.
Well, Greg, you're always gracious. In this case, I think perhaps you are being a little too kind. I don't have either the visibility or the publication impact that he has. And I was also impressed by the ability to relate to his audience, a relatively small one. When you had that fascinating conversation with him in our chapel on Saturday, and then the very large commencement audience, he's an extremely polished speaker. And from my limited perspective as an aged professor, I thought he related the vibe I got from the students at our large commencement ceremonies. He seemed to connect with them in very positive ways. I'd be interested in what you think, because you had a chance to talk with him at length and very, very skillfully on Saturday.
I was impressed with the very same thing. That is, he has great intellectual weight. He is a scholar who does meticulous work, and yet when he talks about things, it doesn't seem heavy laden and dry and sort of unapproachable.
It doesn't seem pompous, unlike some professors.
Right, who shall remain nameless.
Who shall remain nameless, yeah. For sure, buddy.
Right. No, he has this way of clarifying things.
Exactly, that's the word. Yeah,
and of speaking about things in ways that that relatively ordinary people can relate. And he also has a way of leavening with just enough humor, even discussions that are very serious, and you know, sometimes even about rather grave matters. And it's just kind of interesting how the use of just a little bit of humor as almost kind of a leavening agent, in a sense, can kind of help open up your mind a little to kind of think about something that otherwise you just feel like you want to keep at arm's length. I don't know. I think that's, it feels like it happens very naturally for him. It doesn't also come off as sort of pre-planned and calculated, that we're going to talk about something difficult here, so I'm going to crack a little joke here. I mean, it just seems to flow out of his gifts as a very natural communicator. It's very impressive, the sort of array of talents that he has.
Yeah, extremely well put. I think humor is underrated, especially nowadays in these harsh and self-righteous political times. Some of the most effective presidents, I think, not by no means all, but humor, Lincoln preeminent as usual, but humor can be an extremely good leavening agent in politics.
Right. One of the reasons why I said that he reminds me of you in some respects in terms of
your
perspective.
Well, you're very nice.
Well, no, it's true. Is because I can think of all the times on this program when I have framed a question about some rather urgent, even grave matter of the day, and I always felt like your response to those very same events was almost always tempered by the lessons of history, that this thing that seems like an unprecedented calamity and that this cliff we feel like we're about to topple over, well, in fact, America has been in places like that time and time again through our long history, and there's a lot to be learned from history, and I just feel like you happen to be somebody who knows that.
Yeah.
And that has a whole lot to do with with the prism through which you see current events that we talk about.
One great challenge for Americans from the beginning historically is we're extremely forward-looking, literally, and we tend to dismiss the importance of history. I had the good fortune to live in Britain for almost a year, many years ago, when I was a student, and it's one reason I'm so inspired by the fact that our students and faculty and lots of other people travel and increasingly live for a period of time and study, but certainly travel all over the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the exception of Syria and Burma, now Myanmar and North Korea, I mean, one or two other places, it's a great stimulus to thinking and also insight. And one of the first things I noticed about our British friends was, even among younger people, new was not a positive positive statement. It's new, but old. Ah, it's old. I remember thinking as a kid, gee, they're the reverse of us, even though we simplistically tend to think they're the same. And one reason they've been so durable, I do believe, despite their current challenges, this agony over leaving the European Union, Brexit, is they tend more naturally, I think, to have a sense of context. Our constant emphasis on the future is one reason, a big reason why this country is so rich, and it's a big reason why we exploit and innovate technologically as effectively as we do. But in other areas of national life, perhaps we're a little deficient, and that's why just mentioning history gets you extra credit, especially with a thoughtful radio interviewer like you. Okay. I'd be interested in how you prepared. You're always so thoroughly prepared for your interviews, and you ask such knowledgeable questions, if I may ask. What kinds of things did you focus on in getting ready for that really great conversation you had with him?
Oh, the Saturday. And we should maybe explain to our listeners that, although I know quite a few of them were actually there, it was a great, great turnout for a gorgeous Saturday afternoon.
And
it was, you know, really hard for people to know with everything else going on with commencement how many people would come, but there were hundreds of people who came to Siebert. So, yeah, it was an intimidating situation for sure. I was tremendously honored that President Swallow asked me to do that. There were any number of people he could have asked to do that, and it was with Mr. Meacham essentially a back and forth conversation between the two of us, just in front of a live audience, and then at the very end. We open it up for a few questions from the audience. I had already done a brief phone interview with him about his latest book, The Soul of America. And at that point, I had read nearly all of the book, but I finished reading all of it. And then I took notes on some of the most intriguing points he made, quotes I thought I might want to read. And then I realized almost all those quotes were quotes of other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, where he was quoting Abraham Lincoln or quoting Martin Luther King or something, and I realized it would probably be even better if my quotes were actually his words, and he's a wonderful writer. But one of the hallmarks of this book is how generously he quotes important Americans from our history. So I went back actually a second time and started pulling examples of the points he was very specifically making, and made kind of a list of them, and started general and then worked my way to more specific points through some interesting things. And I did try to focus on both Abraham Lincoln and Joe McCarthy, since those are both figures who have some connection to Wisconsin or Carthage. And then the other thing was I tried not to be too organized, because I had no idea how he would speak in front of a live audience, if he would speak more effusively at greater length. And so I had to try to just respond to whatever was going on. And I certainly wanted to keep the spotlight on this important guest as much as possible. So tried to keep any of my remarks to a minimum, unlike what I'm doing right now in talking about the event. But it was a tremendous thrill, and I'm glad that people seemed to appreciate as much as they did. And we had people who drove all the way from Janesville and Madison to be there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, says something about his stature.
I thought you were good enough to have several questions from the audience, even though there wasn't much time remaining. And I thought the questions really, really well reflected the public's voice, especially among those who were relatively concerned about the current state of affairs in our great country. You're certainly right to underscore President Swallow's role, because their personal relationship, I believe, dating from the University of the South initially, that was instrumental in our ability to bring him.
Right. I wanted to get your thoughts on one moment in his commencement address on Sunday, which I thought was marvelously done. And there was a moment early on in the speech where he was basically telling the graduates of 2018, and this is true not only of Carthage's graduates, but anybody graduating this year, that over the course of their young lives, they had already lived through quite a lot in terms of tumult and dramatic changes and so on. And he explained that, at least for most of them, Bill Clinton was president, when they were born, and then of course there were the dramatic events of 9/11, and the presidency of George W. Bush, and then when they were all I don't know what age, America elected its first black president, and some applause erupted in the room from some parts of the audience. Certainly not. It's not that every single person who voted for Barack Obama applauded at that moment, but there was an outburst of some applause from all around the room. And he said one or two brief words and said, and then a few years later, America elected its most dramatically unconventional president in history, or words to that effect, with Donald Trump, and applause erupted from all corners of the room.
Yeah.
And
rather aggressive applause, right. I thought.
But at any rate, I was very impressed with how Mr. Meacham handled that moment, and he put that moment, I thought, very well into perspective. Do you want to say anything about what he said or how that moment sort of was handled?
Yes, thank you for summing up what I was trying to say a couple of minutes ago. He related to his audience intuitively and instinctively very well. I am quite confident I would not have had the wit to, and have it in the past, to phrase it that way, get inside a young person's perspective to a degree, just in terms of the chronology.
Right.
The other really inspiring moment, actually, Jessica Sapolsky, who did the national anthem at our commencement exercise, the other high point for me, I thought she was, the whole ceremony is inspiring and also extremely efficient, I think also reflecting our president's skill at the college. But there was a clarity, and I'd be interested in what you think about these matters. There was a clarity and, if I might say so carefully, a purity to her voice that I found extraordinarily uplifting, especially given the way the national anthem is handled by various show business types at major, especially the more physical sporting events in our country. I thought it was just extraordinarily. I also say carefully, I thought of angelic in terms of traditional imagery. Just so in this area, as in others, our college does, and our students do an extraordinarily good job.
Right. Yeah. I thought it was a great day, and it was great to be there, great to be part of it.
Absolutely.
Course, and certainly exciting to have John Meacham there. And also great to hear from our outgoing president of the trustees, Ambassador David Straz, who also always speaks so very effectively and eloquently. So.
A remarkably successful business entrepreneur who is relatively low profile compared to others, for instance, in the high-tech industry especially, a great philanthropist. He did not have earlier ties to Carthage College. He's closely associated with Marquette before Greg Campbell. The suggestion, it's fine to say, I'm sure, especially now, of Howard Brown, the publisher of the Kenosha News. He brought the two together, and the relationship has blossomed. And Mr. Strass has been an enormously generous
it's incredible.
Donor to the college, but also various other institutions.
Right.
It's also current news that he is a candidate for mayor of Tampa, Florida. And anyone who goes into the arena, as President Kennedy liked to say, since it applied to himself, he emphasized anyone who's in the arena as opposed to just sitting on the sidelines deserves special respect and commendation.
Absolutely. And, of course, that one of the main points of Mr. Meacham's wonderful book is for people who care about the country, the very, very first thing that must happen is you must engage. Can't just sit back and wait for better times or what you believe to be better times to come around the bend. We have to be part of making this country what we want it to be. It's 8:30. For those of you just joining us, we are speaking today with Dr. Art Seer, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. It would be fun to talk about John Meacham all day, but let's talk about a few other things. I know that a lot of people are interested to have your take on this on-again, off-again summit between President Trump and the leader of North Korea, an event that seems to wink in and out of existence by the day, but at the moment appears to be on again, and scheduled
at the moment.
Who
knows what the next moment will bring in this current administration?
Right.
Made for the media, right,
Greg?
Right.
Yeah. So in roughly 2 weeks, maybe this summit is going to be occurring.
But maybe in 2 minutes it'll be off again.
Yeah,
who knows?
Right.
And actually, who cares?
Right. So what significance do you see, first of all, with this summit, if it does occur, and also with this on-again, off-again sort of status of affairs? Is this something you imagine is in any way sort of orchestrated? Is there a point to allowing kind of this volatility before the public regarding this? What do you make of this?
A point to the president's behavior? I believe the point is, and you don't have to be some sort of political or academic genius, the point is to keep the president center stage, in the public eye, the main focus, not policy, but me. Focus on me. If there is a policy to the current administration, it's focus on me.
What do you think?
You're the media guy.
Well, yeah,
I'm just a simple professor.
you
provide the stage for him.
So you think the kind of the on again, off again thing is to just sort of keep this before the public and specifically keep President Trump.
That's the story of his life, conscious or not. Yeah. I do believe he's more spontaneous than calculating, but that may well be underestimating him. He did become president of the United States, contrary to the expectations of a lot of people, including me, sir. Much more important is what's happening below the surface. In diplomacy, that's always true, even in the current situation with our current president. And there has been another summit meeting between President Moon of South Korea, who not only has far more chips on the table, far more skin in the game, literally this really is consequential for him and his people, and the also unpredictable leader of North Korea. There's been a second summit meeting in a rather short period of time. Most unfortunately, you have to dig in today's media. It didn't used to have to dig so much. But you have to dig to look for the real grist, and that's the case. Take a look and focus. If you're a serious person, and we all should be, and people who listen to your program by definition are, especially listening to me, keep an eye on what's going on under the headlines.
So
don't keep your eye on the ball.
Right.
I mean, the sports analogy is quite apt.
Right.
There's a
lot
going on the field.
Sure.
Sorry, even in baseball, despite what's the center of attention, and then the Korea Peninsula especially.
Right. So it sounds like, as far as you're concerned, the really big story here is what is happening between North and South Korea.
Yes, thank you, in a nutshell.
Much more so than what's happening between North Korea and us.
Absolutely. Traditionally, North Korea has gone to great, extreme, painful, counterproductive lengths at times to ignore South Korea. We want to deal with Washington. South Korea doesn't exist for us. Previous administrations, in particular the Bush administration, which had a good deal more discipline, I think, the second Bush administration, and certainly the first than Clinton, but they focused on the six power talks as a way of getting around this rigid, relentless ideological insistence by the communist regime that the South doesn't exist. So there were fitful but continuing talks involving both Koreas, the U.S., China, Russia, and Japan. And I think that's a forum that could be revived. And we have a very serious and experienced Secretary of State currently who has the respect and support of the president, mutual relationship as far as we can tell, at least for the moment, unlike Pompeo's predecessor, Mr. Tillerson. And perhaps he'll, I think watching him, what he's going to do, I think he was superb. I took time to watch as well as listen to his testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And in the context of what I thought was really, for that committee and in the Senate especially, really low-grade, self-serving exhibitionism before the cameras by several senators, I thought he handled himself especially well. I was very impressed. You can see why this guy is a major player in Congress and in our political system and is now Secretary of State.
One thing you said when we maybe last talked about this potential summit between the United States and North Korea is that in your mind, such a summit should be the culmination of a long period of hard-working diplomacy behind the scenes, that the last thing that occurs is maybe a big moment before the television cameras where two leaders actually meet. But it shouldn't start with that. It should end with that. It should mark the culmination of long and meaningful negotiations. And I think you cited the example of Nixon going to China.
And Moscow.
Oh, and Moscow, right.
Just before the 72 election, quite right. No, right. Two major summits.
Right. So in this case, at least as far as we can tell, we have limited evidence that too much of that sort of thing has gone on. This seems like a little more of a spontaneous gesture, maybe on both sides, and that maybe will have some bearing on what sort of fruits are going to emerge from this summit,
yeah,
if there hasn't been that hard work behind the scenes.
Yes, well, I think the gold standard is Nixon and Kissinger and their very skillful associates, especially Winston Lord. Kissinger's at the State Department, but Kissinger's right-hand man. I think he was at the State Department at the time, in terms of relentlessly going to China and making things happen in advance of the show in 72, which was a very good show. Likewise, Nixon and Kissinger were able to get the two SALT I treaties on launchers for both offensive and defensive ICBM systems capped. Yeah, I've thought about that. I think maybe I was being a little too much the arrogant academic, especially I was dismissive of President Kennedy, and we also talked about the disastrous Vienna summit, which he impulsively, unfortunately, with 2020 hindsight, decided to do right after the Bay of Pigs and disaster in Vienna with Khrushchev. I think perhaps I was a little, taking advantage of my privileged position. Kennedy had a very good sense of humor, a leavening influence, among other strengths. Before the Kennedy administration, Eisenhower hosted Nikita Khrushchev at Camp David, and the spirit of Camp David emerged from that. Khrushchev came back in 1960, and then the U-2, mainly to go to the UN, and then the U-2 airplane was shot down, which led to, an end to hopes of a Paris summit between Khrushchev and Ike. But there was a spirit of Camp David, and it was also very educational for Khrushchev. Wherever he went in the Soviet Union for a motorcade or for public events, he was always applauded enthusiastically by the people who had no choice. In his case especially, he was never that popular and still isn't. In contrast to Stalin, for instance. Figure it out. But he was amazed in the U.S. Lots of people turned out, but they were totally silent. And he would say to his underlings, why did the Americans just stand still and stare at me? It was a good education for a totalitarian leader especially. There was a Malta summit. George Bush, another high-energy, sometimes impulsive president like JFK. He met with Gorbachev as the Soviet Union was disintegrating. And I think, again, a good personal relationship, but a lot of the foundation for very positive relations with post-communist Russia were laid at that time. So with people with that much influence and that much savvy to become head of their country, I think, even in the case of the privileged medieval clan that runs North Korea, there may be some benefit to our president and Kim Jong-un coming together.
Interesting.
I think it'll probably happen. But again, who knows? He really is a very, very impulsive individual.
Right. And of course, even if it does happen, who knows what will emerge from it?
Yeah, but as long as this serious dialogue, and Moon is a very serious president. Look at the guy's resume. It's extraordinary. As long as this dialogue is going on between North and South, that's historic. And I'm very glad there are interviewers like you to discuss these matters because even so-called serious media is not paying attention to it.
Yeah, not enough. Let's talk for a moment about
not paying attention to that dimension.
Yeah, right. You know, yeah,
this kind of unholy alliance, as I've raged about before in your program, between the president and the mass media is really serious news is suffering.
Right. We should talk a little less about the president's tweets and a little more
about his vices and you know the unattractive aspects of his personality personally.
Let's talk for a moment about tariffs. One of the top stories on NPR today is the question kind of hanging in the air about tariffs that President Trump announced that would be imposed on, I believe, Canada, Mexico, and the EU in terms of steel and aluminum. Mm-hmm. And the question about whether or not he's going to go ahead with those tariffs comes in the wake of sort of the tumult between the United States and China over some very tough talk from the Trump administration.
Yeah, that's more intellectual property. I don't think China's a major steel producer for us.
Right. No,
you're
no, no.
Quite it's, right. It's our good friends who are, you know, providing most steel.
Right. No, that's kind of a different matter, but it's just related in the sense of
But you brought up China quite rightly.
Right. Yeah. But the point of that sometimes President Trump makes very strong statements and then for one reason or another walks them back, and in the case of China very much walked back his initial statements and so on. So first of all, in a nutshell, what would the point be of these announced tariffs? Why does a nation impose tariffs on another nation? And in this particular case, what would be the consequences if these announced tariffs would go through?
We do it to protect our home market, and nations traditionally do it to protect their domestic base. The problem is that over the long term, it tends to be self-defeating and counterproductive. Efficiencies go down. Prices, especially for basic consumer durables, go up in our international system. And the president's base are the people who are going to be hurt, working people who are generally not high income or highly educated. That's the fact, not some bias. They're going to be hurt the most. But that's a kind of academic, again, evaluation. We've faced tremendous, not unprecedented, but tremendous disruption in our domestic economy for several decades and more. And a lot of people have been disrupted and hurt. Unemployment is now nil in the United States, extraordinary, but an awful lot of people, especially white males, both young and older, have simply fallen off the radar. They've given up and withdrawn from the workforce. A profoundly important problem in this country that is discussed not at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean really not at all, very rarely. That's the context in which the president makes these statements. He's appealing to his base and a lot of other people, and China especially has been guilty of behavior that is unacceptable and illegal under the current rules of the game, and I think they should be called out. What the president has done quite brilliantly is he beats the drum and blows the bugle and with great bombast announces these, and then he doesn't actually follow up. I had the good fortune not only to be around you and Mr. Meacham and President Swallow and our great young people, including the beautiful singer, but also our colleague Yuri Maltsev on short notice, Herman Mashaba, mayor of Johannesburg,
right,
and another very successful business entrepreneur on short notice, came through with a large number of relatives. His daughter, the Mashaba's daughter, is graduated from Carthage. Another outstanding, impressive young person. And so Yuri, on no notice, had a small gathering over at his and Rita's home, and it's always good to see that fine family. And he grabbed me at the last minute. Tom Klein, vice president for advancement at Carthage, was also good enough to come. But Yuri, with great emphasis, made the same point. with far more detail. He's very conservative and libertarian and basically supports President Trump, and he made exactly the same point with considerable detail. I'm very proud and happy about the fact that you now have Professor Maltsev on your program regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how recently. This would be a good time to have him back.
Right, we could
good
certainly.
Time to have him back. So, yeah, President Trump is remarkably effective in certain ways in the media, both as an entertainer and now as a political leader.
Interesting.
It is interesting, yeah. And that's the best answer to your question. So far, things remain in place. We have, since the last year of World War II, a firm foundation. Use the shorthand term Bretton Woods is used to refer to these rather complicated economic institutions of the United Nations. One of them, the World Bank, was led by Tom Clawson back in the challenging 1980s. They survive. They've changed dramatically, but they survive and provide some governance. Not world government, I hasten to add, mm-hmm. not global government, which some people worry about. That doesn't exist. But these mechanisms for mediation, arbitration, and rule enforcement do exist. And China has appealed to them, is using them to counter some of the limited moves the U.S. government has made. Those institutions grew out of world war, and it's important to emphasize, again, they're not in the headlines, but they are working, and they haven't been abandoned, like the League of Nations was abandoned in the 30s. We never joined, but the major powers, one of the first things, the Third Reich, they were careful about other things. One of the first things they did was get out of the League of Nations and work to destroy it, which they did.
Let's talk for a moment about two nations you wrote about in your column, Malaysia and Indonesia.
Ah!
And there's two countries that tend not to be anywhere in our headlines.
Yeah,
but
I should have reread the column. You're really getting to the margins here.
Right. But no, it was quite interesting. You were really kind of comparing these two Far Eastern nations, Malaysia for dramatic elections which occurred there in which the oldest head of government in the world right now was elected, a 92-year-old prime minister, if I remember correctly. And you were contrasting that with the kind of the sorry state of affairs in Indonesia, which has been racked with all kinds of terrorism and corruption and so on. And I think one of the points of your column was that if either of those nations is in the headlines right now, it would be Indonesia for some of these really terrible outbreaks of violence. But really, the headline story should be that of Malaysia and the fact that this nation is functioning as well as it is, and that this latest election, which I guess was in some respects a surprise in terms of its results, is an example of a healthy nation.
They're both examples of healthy nations. Thank you for bringing that up. It's good discipline for me. I did write the column, but you know, I researched these things. I do one a week, and we've also been at the end of the semester at Carthage, which involves a little bit of grading. Yeah, not too much frantic scrambling, but a bit. Indonesia is the largest Muslim nation, majority nation, the largest Islamic majority nation on the planet, a gigantic country, a gigantic population, a gigantic oil producer. There was a terrorist incident, very limited. Any human life lost violently is a tragedy. A couple of families of fanatics, they involved their young children, which is particularly criminal, carried out suicide bombings that killed and injured a few people. And Al-Qaeda immediately took credit. A lunatic in San Bernardino opens fire, kills. Al-Qaeda's there to take, or ISIS or some combination, they're there to take credit. Another downside of the media world, these are freelance insane people who become killers, and an Islamic extremist group takes credit in the media. Those are the facts. Indonesia has no tolerance for terrorism. Islamic radicalism has no base in this enormous population. There have been much larger terrorist attacks, including one that killed a number of Australians not long after 9/11, one of our closest and most important military allies in the world, not just the South Pacific. So this made headline news, even though the context, it's not really worthy of global attention, but that's what it received. Indonesia is now having elections. And since you're kind enough always to open the door to historical comparison, by contrast, during the height of the Cold War, the U.S. government was rightly concerned about Indonesia's movement into what was called and was the communist orbit. Hmm. They were closely associated with the Soviet Union increasingly. By the mid-1960s, the Soviet Navy and the Indonesian Navy were becoming integrated. They were integrating crews. They weren't just having joint exercises. They were becoming a unified naval force near what was and is one of the largest trade routes in the world through the South China Sea and toward the west from East Asia. It's one big reason why President Johnson and his advisors, faced with a desperate situation in South Vietnam, decided to escalate. First, Rolling Thunder, the bombing campaign against the North, which started in February. We were already bombing the hell out of large parts of South Vietnam and killing a lot of, and machine gunning and bombing a lot of people. And the big conventional escalation, starting with the Marines going into Da Nang in the spring. I was at Army ROTC summer camp at Fort Lewis, Washington in the summer of 1965, and I well remember the total silence in our barracks as President Johnson made his speech to the people announcing this finally going public with what was a massive escalation. There's total silence in the barracks, and immediately an entire division's infantry division started moving out of Fort Lewis. Serious times. We don't live in that context today. In the case of Malaysia, there are also significant security dimensions and lessons. There was an alteration in government for the first time since Malaya became independent of Great Britain way back in the 50s. Malaysia is a funny combination of several different small countries related to the endless British Empire in an earlier time. There's massive corruption in Indonesia. It's a lot less than it used to be. They have democratic elections. There's massive corruption in Malaysia, but a lot less than there used to be, and it's going to go down dramatically because there's now finally been a change in government for the first time. Makes Mayor Daley and the Chicago Machine look like a pretty brief tenure. Also of great interest to the U.S. government during the Vietnam period, the British actually addressed, contained, and wiped out a communist insurgency in Malaya in the 50s. Sir Robert Thompson, sort of guru of guerrilla warfare, who deserved the credentials, he knew what he was talking about. He had been very much involved in that exercise and was an advisor to the Johnson administration. Then Nixon and Kissinger, who were desperate for new approaches in Vietnam that would work, years later they brought him back. The British are extremely effective at this kind of counterinsurgency, not just in Malaya, but in Kenya during the Mau Mau uprising, in South Africa at the turn of the last century during the Boer War. There's a lot we can learn from them. Max Boot, a journalist, younger man who's fascinated by guerrilla warfare, is another very prolific author. He has a book out concerning an individual who was very much involved in Vietnam War policy early on. He argues in The Road Not Taken, if only we'd continued to emphasize guerrilla warfare, we could have prevailed in Vietnam. He's absolutely wrong. Absolutely off base. Colonel Lansdale, the gentleman he writes about, I had some passing contact with him when I was young. I know a lot about him. That was not an option for us. Beware, because this is all so long ago, beware of those who want to return to this perspective that we have great impact in the world just because of who we are and that unconventional warfare is some kind of opportunity for Americans. Unlike for the British, who are far more professional and effective, far more disciplined in their use of firepower, and also much more inclined to negotiate. One reason why they're so durable negotiation was psychologically unacceptable to President Johnson. We don't have that kind of flexibility, I think, culturally, but we can learn a lot from those who do. And these are points I tried to make a lot more economically than I am this morning, but in 600 words. That's the two points the column makes.
Yeah.
And of course, as usual, our even the serious media, we're basically passing. We misinterpret what's going on in Indonesia and exaggerate the danger, and we totally ignore, for all practical purposes, what's going on in Malaysia.
Right, in the central story there. Yeah,
Lansdale was an ad man. Our listeners, Mad Men, that's something more contemporary. Don Draper is a really nice, very disciplined, very focused executive compared to Mr. Lansdale. He was an ad man in New York, phenomenal self-promoter. There's a reason why he,
So don't believe his book.
Read the book. Read the book. Buy the book.
Okay.
Mr. Boot's a very serious young man, but... read lots of different things about this important subject. We're already getting sucked in to more than one serious killing encounter in the world, currently in Syria. There's been direct combat between Russian mercenaries and U.S. special forces. Like several hundred were killed by American troops. We haven't revealed our own losses. How many of your serious listeners know about that? That happened early this month. Sorry to go off on a tangent, but in this case, I think it's for a good reason.
Right. Well, then it's not a tangent, really, when it's that important.
Well, you're very generous.
Right. Well, now I'm really reluctant to ask this last question, but we only have a couple of minutes, so we won't spend too much time doing it. I'm just curious, since your last visit, did you watch any of the royal wedding? And I know... causes you great consternation that one of the things that's crowded off much more important stories from the news has been the relentless focus on coverage on that royal wedding. That being said, do you think it has any significance, this American princess marrying Prince Harry? Is there a significant story there for us?
Well, Professor Berg, I'm devastated that you would think that I would be so limited as to not appreciate the royal wedding. It's not, unlike Indonesia and Malaysia, I didn't put it up on my blog late last night because I knew you'd be taking a look probably early this morning.
Right.
But last week's column was about the royal wedding.
Oh.
And if you go on the internet and search under Arthur I. Sear for Irving and royal wedding, you will see an article that delves into the great significance of this.
Oh.
Queen Elizabeth is head of state, also in her 90s, but not head of government. Remarkably effective, and the article discusses the important influence of an indirect sort that the monarch has, and refers to Edward VIII, who became the itinerant Prince of Wales with his American wife after he abdicated the throne. Marrying the woman he loved was a public story. The British parties and government were extraordinarily anxious to get rid of him because he was pro-Nazi. And George VI turned out to be the ideal partner, political and strategic, for Prime Minister Churchill during that terrible war. Edward VIII would have been a disaster. The Germans constantly cultivated him as a strategic asset, even as the Prince of Wales, which is why Churchill sent him and his notorious wife, Wallis, to the Bahamas to get him as far away as possible. The Germans were trying to get him to go to Spain. And I go on and on about Elizabeth I, a truly great historic political leader from a few years ago. So read the column.
Oh, I missed that. I saw the one about the royal baby, but that was earlier, but I missed this
there's
more
a lot
recently.
Going on with the royal family. No. Subscribe to the Kenosha News. It will arrive on your doorstep in paper form, and you can read every... week's column.
And not miss one. Well,
Betsy Brown as well as Howard Brown and others. Thank
very,
you. No, it's a good newspaper. Yeah, they published my column.
Absolutely is. No.
Support the college generously.
Very good.
No, it's a very important point, and I should have sent you that column, too.
Well, I'm anxious to read that and glad to hear
it's
that
very
you
important.
Saw.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly says a lot about where Britain is at the moment and the way they see themselves in the world and the way they are seen in the world. So, well, I will look for that. And on that note, that was a happy note on which to finish. Dr. Art Sear is Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. This is always a pleasure, always fun. I look forward to seeing
you
next month.
Well, I'm glad it's fun, Greg.
Thanks for being here.
Not everybody thinks I'm fun.
I do, and good to have you here today on the morning show. Tomorrow, Sergei Prokhiev, the author of what is already regarded as the